The last-minute push is on as supporters and opponents of County Referendum Number 1 make their case. Good Monday morning. Hope you had a nice weekend out there. We're live from Studio 5 with First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. We are always live at 9. Make sure to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and the WJCT app, or watch the show with video on demand at our partner, TVJax.com. Just ahead, a final pension preview as you, the voters, decide. Get on the line now and let us know how you'll vote at 549-2937. Then later, First Coast Success speaks with former sheriff and college president Nat Glover. Plus, we've got sports with Cole and a peek inside the listening room at Mudville Grill. All of that and more ahead this hour. But first this morning, voters will go to the polls tomorrow in Duval County to decide the fate of County Referendum Number 1. Quite a few have already voted early. The measure, of course, is Mayor Lenny Curry's plan to fix Jacksonville's massive pension problem, an unfunded liability tallying into the billions that is crippling city finances. Strong arguments are being made right now, both for and against the plan, as many are voting early. This morning, we take a final look at the issue. It's your official pension preview as we welcome veteran reporter David Bauerlein of the Florida Times Union. He's been covering this issue for some time. David, good to have you with us.
Good morning.
And joining us in studio, Tom Majonix, a Jacksonville citizen who has spoken out against the proposal. Good morning to see you. Good to see you, too.
Good morning, Melissa.
And you're the executive director of KIPP Schools in the city, but you're speaking as a private citizen about this issue. And we want everybody's calls, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email, tweet us, weigh in on our Facebook page. We'll get to all of your feedback in just a moment. David Bauerlein, let's begin with you. You're very well-versed in the particulars of the city's pension problems and this proposal. We do need to disclose that the Florida Times Union, on its front page, took the unusual step of placing an editorial on the front page urging people to vote yes on County Referendum Number 1. You, of course, though, as a reporter, are just a neutral documenter of these issues. Let's talk about the arguments for and against. Mayor Lenny Curry is saying that this is really the best possible option right now to get a head start on attacking Jacksonville's pension debt. When we look at the for argument, the Yes for Jacksonville campaign, what are your thoughts?
Well, I think the argument that the for Jacksonville campaign would make to voters is that there's this huge debt. It's not negotiable. It has to be paid. The way to do it is to create a dedicated funding revenue source for it, which is what this sales tax would do. And it's a way to have a dedicated funding source that does not raise taxes on residents now, and would not, they argue, raise taxes either in the future, because it would take effect after the existing half-cent sales tax for the Better Jacksonville plan expires in 2030. So it's a way to solve the problem without having a tax increase, and ultimately...
Oh, we lost David. We're going to try to get him back on the line and give us a call with your thoughts about County Referendum 1. Let us know what you'll vote. 549-2937. Tom Majonix, you've editorialized against County Referendum Number 1. And your argument basically is that this plan is, in your words, all tax, no reform. Why is that?
Well, correct, Melissa. I believe there are literally a billion and a half reasons to vote no on Tuesday. According to the city's very own pension advisors, kicking the can of our pension debts to be ultimately paid later this century is going to cost taxpayers an additional $1.5 billion to pay down a pension debt. Now, you're not going to see this extra $1.5 billion cost to taxpayers in the ballot summary when you vote. We also haven't heard a peep about the $1.5 billion from the mayor as he sold his plan across town. And while there's been a zillion literally Yes for Jacksonville ads on the air, of course, none of them mention the extra $1.5 billion that taxpayers will pay. So we've seen ads describing the referendum as conservative. I got one in my mailbox last week. But what's conservative about wasting $1.5 billion of taxpayer money on interest? And interestingly, there's also been ads describing the referendum as progressive. But what's progressive about kicking the can of this problem to our city's kids and then handing them a multi-billion dollar bill to pay when they are adults in the years 2030 to 2060 with interest included. So that's a large part of why I'm voting no and ask listeners to do the same tomorrow at the polls.
You've advocated a more comprehensive reform of the pension system and a $1 million property tax increase. What about the mayor's arguments that future administrations could take those property tax revenues and put them towards something other than the pension liability?
We basically need to hold our public officials accountable. In a similar vein, who knows what might happen in the year 2030 to 2060 and what shenanigans politicians might come up with then to modify the tax. A lot of us won't be around in the year 2030 to 2060. Ultimately, an alternate path of across-the-board comprehensive pension reform combined with aggressive debt repayment would cost taxpayers billions less than the mayor's plan and reduce the city's financial risk. And we spare our kids from paying for debts that they didn't create. We ultimately need to pay our debts now and avoid the temptation to kick the can. That's going to save billions in interest costs that taxpayers will be paying through county referendum number one, $1.5 billion over time.
David Barreline of the Florida Times Union back with us now. What about those who are against this idea, saying that it adds an extra billion to the overall debt? The mayor's office has pushed back against that argument. What about that piece of this?
Well, I think the argument there is that the plan the mayor has put forward does not put an additional tax burden on taxpayers. And so the idea is that because it starts later in 2031, there is no net increase in the tax. And so that is the essential argument that, in terms of the future generations argument, that they will be paying the same tax rate for sales taxes as current taxpayers are right now. Tom is right that there is an additional cost that is paid over the long run because of the way that the tax, the cost for repaying the pension debt would be pushed off into the future to some extent as a result of waiting for the sales tax to kick in.
You've also argued, Tom Ajonics, that the city needs complete across-the-board reform of all of the city's pension plans by, in your words, cutting excess Wall Street investment fees paid by the pension system, renegotiating less generous future benefits for new and current employees. What would you say to City Hall's argument that that there are limitations to what can be negotiated when it comes to the unions?
Well, the mayor's on the record stating that current city pension benefits are dysfunctional, that they, quote, don't represent the market, and they're financially unsustainable. And I believe he's absolutely right. It's interesting, Florida Politics reported last week that if this referendum were to pass, he projects that negotiations with the unions will be done by spring. So I think it's ultimately comes down to how aggressive the mayor wants to be with negotiations. So he believes that the negotiations to the close the plans to new employees would take a handful of months.
Let's go to your calls right now about County Referendum 1. Early voting's already underway. Something like 14% of you have already cast a ballot in this August primary election, but Election Day is tomorrow. How do you stand on the Yes for Jacksonville plan, pension reform for Duval County? It's 549-2937. Jason is in San Marco with us. Hey, Jason. Good morning.
Good morning. I support your in-studio guest 100%. I will be voting no. I think this is an embarrassment that the mayor, who is an accountant, would present this as an answer to this quote-unquote emergency that we're facing, that we'll start paying for it in 2031. And I'm kind of in shock, Melissa, that citizens are buying into this when we should start paying off on this now, immediately, and not waiting. And there should be a balanced approach to how we pay for it. And I agree we should have a small property tax increase. That's my comment, and I really appreciate you giving me a chance to share it with you.
Jason, do you own a home in San Marco?
I do own a house. Actually, I rent, but I mean, I'm a realtor, so I understand how real estate taxes work, and most people will pass that on to their tenant. But if we got an emergency, if we got a hurricane sitting offshore coming on, you put the shutters up now. You don't wait until the storms hit and left. You
okay.
Take care of it now.
All
We've
right.
been scared. We've been told it's an emergency. It has to be dealt with now. And the answer we're being told is we'll start paying on it in 16 years. I don't get it.
All right. Thanks, Jason. Tom Majanik, obviously you agree with him. What about, and I'm going to quote here David and Tom from the Times Union's editorial urging a yes vote. Property taxes hit small businesses harder than homeowners. In Duval, there's not only an exemption for homeowners, but a special one for low income and elderly ones. What about the argument that a property tax hike would hurt small business in this city?
I acknowledge that, but at the end of the day, taxpayers will be paying an additional $1.5 billion over time by kicking the can down the road, and that hurts everybody, small businesses included. I also reject the notion that this county referendum has been marketed as a tax extension. If this referendum passes, then Jacksonville's kids, when they're in charge, will be paying twice for their city government. They're going to be responsible for funding the city's needs during their time, and also charged with paying down this legacy pension debt that we handed them with interest. And this would be unprecedented in our city's history. So the claim that county referendum number one is a tax extension is a fabrication, in my opinion. Plain and simple, I think voters are being asked to preemptively raise taxes on our kids by handing them our pension debt to ultimately pay, except, of course, our kids can't vote and weigh in on this issue. We can leave our kids a much better legacy, and taxing children is not the answer to our pension debt crisis.
David Bauerlein, your thoughts.
Well, the property tax rate was increased by the city council by 14% back in 2013, so the argument that it would be a hard hit on businesses is that they absorbed a tax increase just 3 years ago. If you went out by another mill, that would be another 8% tax increase, somewhere in that range. So that would be a significant increase in the tax rate. And they are paying more even with the same tax rate now because the property values of their businesses are going up with the economic recovery. So there is an impact that would come on the business bottom line, on the general economy, if you were to increase the property tax rate.
All right. Let's go to Steve on the South Side. Hi, Steve. How are you?
Very good. I voted no for the pension tax, and it's been on a little different theory, though, that I really haven't heard discussed yet. I understand that we are stuck with $5 million cops. But what bothers me is that virtually
only a handful, by the way, just to be clear. Yeah, it's not as if they're all. Yeah. But yes, I understand your concern. Go ahead, Steve.
Fair enough. What seems to happen, though, is that every politician gets up and seems to draw a straight line between JSO's budget and public safety. And their budget is basically sacrosanct. It cannot be touched. We've spent more money, Mr. Curry has hired more police, and we still have the drive-by shootings. It wasn't very long ago that the ex-sheriff, Matt Glover, decided to pay out a $2,000 bonus to virtually all of the retirees. My question is, has anyone taken a very hard and very analytic look at JSO's budget and seen better efficiencies, getting cops out from behind the desk like any other Fortune 500 company does? And that is basically my question. Is there a way of doing this that would combine this shared pain with some other sort of a tax that we probably need?
All right. Thanks for that call, Steve. Appreciate it. Tom?
I haven't looked at the JSO budget in detail, but I have looked at the benefits, and indeed, the $5 million cop is a rarity. But if you, the devil's in the details in pensions, and the average police and fire employee begins to collect a pension starting in their late 40s after 20 years of work. And if you add up those decades of benefits plus their lavish drop perk, on average, every police and fire retiree.
And to be clear, yeah, they do not draw Social Security.
That is
so
true.
So they get drop in instead of Social Security.
Right. But they're going to receive about $4 million on average in lifetime benefits. Mm-hmm. Now, people, indeed, Social Security is something that our city employees don't pay into. But let's look at Social Security. So the average American worker with an average income collects Social Security benefits at age 66, not in their late 40s. And after a lifetime of work, not 20 years, that average American worker is going to get about $400,000 and benefits during the remaining years. About $16,000 is the average Social Security check that's received across America, and I assume is similar to Jacksonville. So you have 400 grand of lifetime benefits in Social Security for a lifetime of work, $4 million in guaranteed pension benefits after work in 20 years, guaranteed by the taxpayer.
David Barreline, what about that? The argument that this plan hasn't been aggressive enough in terms of renegotiating current and future retirement benefits?
Well, one point to be made is when we talk about the $2.8 billion pension debt, that is for pension obligations that have already been incurred to date. So going forward, that can't be changed. That has to be paid one way or the other. By law, it's not negotiable. Going forward, the things that might be looked at in terms of negotiations, they did do negotiations last year with police and firefighter pensions, and they did scale back considerably pension benefits that new hires can earn to a point that they are really comparable to the Florida retirement system, which is what other counties in our area pay their police and firefighters. When you get into the existing employees, presumably there could be room if they wanted to negotiate further. It's not an easy negotiation in that respect. And they did go through that last year and did have some concessions, but I'm not sure how much could be done or achieved through further negotiations in terms of what savings would be. Certainly there could be a potential for negotiating further with police and firefighters. And another point to be made is that for corrections officers and for general employees, that's wide open territory. There have been really no changes in their pension benefits for years. So that's the place where the city could negotiate and potentially come up with more affordable packages for taxpayers.
And Tom Ajonics, what about the mayor's argument that that is part of the plan in the long run? You're not buying that.
You know, there's rhetoric of reform in county referendum number one, but again, the devil's in the details. So according to the ballot, quote unquote, up to three of our plans can be closed to new employees. But ultimately, for the tax to be enacted, just one plan needs to be closed to new employees. So the questions that come up is, well, which plan or plans are going to be closed? What's it going to be replaced with? Will we see any savings? What happens to the other plans? And we've seen zero details. We ultimately have to pass this new tax first. Then we could find out what's in it. And I think that's backwards. The other piece that's important is that in the referendum, city employees would indeed increase their pension contributions that they pay into the system from 8% of salary at present up to 10%. And at first blush, that sounds good. But again, the devil's in the details. Some of the increased employee contributions can only happen after the employees receive a 3% raise that's ultimately funded by taxpayers. So this largely negates the effect of the higher employee contribution. So it's a nice soundbite, but in the big scheme of things, it's window dressing. It's like downgrading the floor mats in a Cadillac. It saves a few bucks, but still the core product is incredibly expensive.
Let's take one more call. It's Tom on the West Side. Hi, Tom. What are your thoughts?
Yes, good morning.
Hey.
I've already voted no on it, too, and my principal objection to it is if it's an emergency, waiting till 2031 seems a bit delayed. Also, I'm really perturbed that we talk about this big crisis, and no one's ever wanted to look into how we got here. I would like to at least have some idea of who got us in this mess.
Well, that's a long story. Thanks for that. David Barreline, we're running a little tight on time. Let's close with you. We got to this point over many administrations and many players, but your final thoughts.
Yeah, in terms of how we got there, I mean, there was a big stock market crash in 2008, and that really undercut the investment portfolios the pension plans had. Also, over time, the city was not putting enough money into the plans, and there were assumptions that hadn't been updated in terms of what the overall cost would be of the plan. So you put those two together, and that created the crisis in terms of something outside the city's control, the stock market crash, and something that should have been within the city's control, which is how much it was putting into those plans going over the last 15 years, probably.
Well, good arguments and lots of information that I hope was of value to all the listeners out there. Thank you both gentlemen so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We were joined by the Times Union's David Bauerlein and Yes for Jacksonville opponent Tom Majonix. Again, early voting's underway, but the official election is tomorrow. Much more still ahead. Later, a look at the listening room at Mudville Grill from veteran promoter Ray Lewis. Also, author Lou Aguilar. But up next, First Coast Success talks with Nat Glover. Back in a moment.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the new CEO of Donald Trump's campaign is closely aligned with the so-called alt-right nationalist movement that rejects multiculturalism. The rise of the alt-right movement and its place in this year's presidential campaign.
Weekdays at 10, right after First Coast Connect on 89.9 FM WJCT.
The world of Downton Abbey, indelibly etched into our memories.
There's never a dull moment in this house.
Characters we can't forget.
I'm John Bates, the new valet.
Twists and turns we couldn't stop talking about.
I won't allow it!
Marigold is my daughter.
I'm Alan Leach, and I played Tom Branson. Please join us for our marathon of all six seasons of Downton Abbey this Labor Day weekend. You won't want to miss it.
Coming September 2nd to WJCT Public Television.
On the next performance today, Jake Shimabukuro joins us in studio.
A lot of times when I tell people that I play the ukulele, you know, they'll say, oh, like that Tiny Tim guy. For me, I embrace that side of the instrument, but at the same time, you can also create very, you know, beautiful and moving music.
Jake Shimabukuro on the next performance today.
Weeknights at 7 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, he served with distinction as the first African-American sheriff elected in Florida since Reconstruction. These days, Nat Glover is leading as president of Edward Waters College. In today's First Coast Success, he shares what he's learned with Karen Mathis. Take a listen.
Nathaniel Glover, well known as Nat Glover, is the president of Edward Waters College, the historically black college founded in Jacksonville 150 years ago in 1866. Glover was installed 5 years ago as the permanent president after serving as interim president, and before that, as Jacksonville's sheriff, among other community and leadership positions. His story of rising to the leadership helm of Edward Waters College is one of determination, perseverance, and help from those who believed in him. Nat Glover, welcome to First Coast Success.
Just glad to be here, Karen.
You grew up in Jacksonville, and you are a graduate of Edward Waters College. Talk about what led you to attend Edward Waters College.
Well, it's not necessarily one of those stories that I think people like to tell, and that is this relentless pursuit of higher education, or that maybe I was so motivated by the prospect of gaining knowledge for a future. It just wasn't a situation like that. I actually wanted to quit school at an earlier point in my life, and the reason I wanted to quit school was because my peer group that I was associating with in the neighborhood seemed to have been doing pretty well, and they were not going to school, and their parents were not insisting that they go to school. And I went to my mother, and I said, Mom, I was going to try to cut a deal with her. See, Mom, see, you know, some of the other kids are not going to school, and they see this. So she stopped me in the middle of the statement And she said this, and it changed my life, really. She said, unforgivingly, son, if you're going to stay in this house, you're going to school. And that was the reason I went to school. And I spent 1 year playing high school football. And I got a scholarship to go to Edward Waters College. And when I got to Edward Waters College, the coach told me I had to do three things. Play well enough to stay on the team. And I had to make certain I got my lesson so I could stay eligible to play. And I had to clean the restroom every day. And I will say this, Karen, if you haven't cleaned the public restroom, you haven't lived. And I did that, cleaned that restroom every day. And do you know where that restroom is located? 10 steps from the president's office.
That restroom's still there?
The restroom is still there. And believe me, it will be there as long as I am there.
Wow, that's a great story. So you graduated, and then you joined the law enforcement field.
Yes, I did. But let me just tell you, that wasn't as simple either. Because, as been publicized, I had been arrested when I was 17 years old. And working at Morrison Cafeteria, had a few napkins in my pocket, too. I stopped by the police one night. They asked me some questions about something else, and they searched me. I had two napkins from the cafeteria. I worked in the dish room. We used them as handkerchiefs. And the detectives arrested me for the two napkins. So when I got ready to become a police officer after graduating from Edward Waters College, I couldn't get any traction. People told me there was no reason to put in because they were not going to hire you. But my brother knew a police officer who was a good friend, and he told him that my brother has just graduated from college. He wanted to become a police officer, and he has an arrest record. And he can't get the opportunity to take the test. So this police officer, I'll never forget his name. His name is Marvin Young. He said, well, let me talk to him. So Marvin Young, because he said he knew the mayor, I had no hopes of that being a successful road because everybody says they know the mayor. So with me in tow, we went up to City Hall, went to the mayor's office. And Karen, I will say this, I'll never forget walking into that mayor's office. When I walked into the mayor's office with Marvin Young in front of me, the mayor's secretary jumped up out of her seat and said, hey, Marvin, how the family? And I said to myself, we on to something here. And we went in and he introduced me to the mayor and the mayor listened to my story. I learned later that he went down to the Civil Service Board to call the Civil Service Board officials in and made a strong case for giving Nathaniel Glover an opportunity to take the test. The mayor's name is Lou Ritter, and he almost had to threaten them because they said that they just didn't do that for people who've been arrested. And they also kind of reminded him that they work for a civil service board, not the mayor. And I think he had to remind them that he appoints the board. And I got an opportunity to sit for the test, and the rest is history.
Well, Nat Glover, president of Edward Waters College and former sheriff, thank you for joining First Coast Success.
Thank you.
You can read a partial transcript of Karen's talk with Nat Glover in today's Financial News and Daily Record. Back in a moment.
Mm-hmm. WJCT's Goodbye Summer Auction is where you'll find over 300 items, most starting at 75% off at auction.wjct.org. Packages include lodging, attractions, dining, recreation, beauty, and more. Bid now. The auction continues through August 31st at 8 p.m. Log on to auction.wjct.org for more information.
I'm David Luckin, host of the Electro Lounge, inviting you to join me Tuesday through Saturday nights on 89.9 when we bring you music from around the world. All styles played, all songs considered. Join me for the Electro Lounge, Tuesday through Saturday nights.
Welcome back. Well, show us how much you love WJCT on Instagram. Our theme this week is voting. Post your voting pictures to Instagram with the hashtag #ILoveWJCT. We'll pick our favorite in our Friday First Read e-newsletter. Subscribe to that at WJCTnews.org. Well, it's a timely tale in this fractious election year. With a down-on-his-luck campaign manager, an unpopular local mayor, a dog, and lots of laughs, the new book Jake for Mayor is a nice escape from our nasty politics of the moment. It's the debut novel for Cuban-born screenwriter Lou Aguilar. Lou will be speaking about it tomorrow night at the Bookmark in Neptune Beach and joins us now with a preview. Good to see you.
Oh, thank you very much, Melissa.
So this began as a screenplay, is that right?
It did, yes. I was sitting there in Venice Beach, and I was getting a lot of B-movies made. And I won't tell you the title, but if you...
Oh, come on, give me
if
one.
If you're drunk watching Cinemax at 3 in the morning, you may catch a couple of mine. One of them's okay. Called Elektra, which Maxim magazine named number 33 in the 50 coolest B-movies of all time.
Very nice.
So... And well, anyway, that was my sordid past. But I'd been writing A scripts, and then this beautiful woman shows up on Venice Beach and walks right up to me, and I'm thinking, actress. Obviously, she wants to be in my next classic, Sisters of Sin.
Okay, but that wasn't what it was?
And not at all. Well, obviously, she hadn't heard the story of the actress who was so dumb she dated the writer, but that would have been fine with
yeah,
me.
Yeah, aren't they at the bottom of the food chain in Hollywood?
Yeah, we are. But it turned out she was a fellow writer, just my luck, and she was from Erie, Colorado, a tiny town in Colorado outside of Denver, and she said, my hometown just ran a dog for mayor.
A dog named Jake.
A dog named Jake for mayor. Do you think this is something Disney or another company may be interested in?
Uh-huh.
And of course, looking at her, I said, absolutely. We are going to have to work on this day and night.
But it was a good story.
It was a great story.
Leaving aside how pretty she was.
Her name was Tammy Norton, and she and I developed the story, and I turned it into a screenplay. And it got optioned. It would get optioned every year. I mean, I was basically living off it, but it never went across the field goal, you know?
Yeah. Hollywood turnaround, right?
Hollywood turnaround, exactly. So a couple of years ago, last year, I said, we need uplifting, especially with this crazy, depressing election coming along. I said, we need an uplifting something. And I turned it into a novel. And this lovely company called Penmore Press, specializing in historical novels, they're great. They took me right away. So it's the opposite of Hollywood.
I mean, that's great. You got a yes.
I got a yes. And everyone's really liking it, and I appreciate it.
And it is fun. And basically, it's the story of a campaign manager who, let's just say...
He's
a complicated guy, right?
It's very Capra-esque. I mean, the story is he's a very cynical guy, and he's at the bottom of his career, and he ends up in this small town, basically stranded in a small town. And he figures if he can get this dog elected mayor, he'll be back on top. The publicity will put him back on top. Of course, the town itself will be a laughing stock, but he doesn't care about that. I mean, it's his career. But the more time passes, the more he gets to like the people, the lovely waitress. And the dog's an angelic kind of figure. And if you like dogs, you'll appreciate it.
So if I'm giving the Hollywood pitch, I'd say it's like Groundhog Day, but with a dog.
It's more like Mr. Deeds Goes to Town. I'm not dating myself. That was made before I was born.
No, but you know, and what's cool about it is that this actually did happen.
The idea of the dog running for mayor actually happened. Everything else, the campaign manager, we actually fictionalized.
And your timing's perfect.
Oh, it is.
Because people are really interested in politics right now, but they're also really disgusted by it.
Well, they asked me, that's funny you should say that, Melissa. They asked me if Jake ran against Hillary or Trump, who would win? And I said, I don't know if Trump could be either one of those, but he'd certainly be more likable than both of them. It's like this. What's the difference between your widely despised candidate and ours, about 3 points right now. You know, that's a joke.
But everybody can get behind this adorable dog.
Yeah. If you're gonna support one candidate this year, it's Jake.
It's Jake for mayor.
Yes.
Now, we don't want to give away the ending.
No.
But the incumbent mayor in your town,
Charles
Dunbar,
of course,
he is very concerned about the humiliation of what might happen if he loses to a dog. Right.
I'm not saying there's any relation to today's current events, but this, he thinks there's a joke of a candidate that there's no way. He's like showboat, and all of a sudden he starts rising in the polls. I'm not saying that's happening, but happens.
Some analogies people might see. Now, you are going to be talking about this tomorrow night at the Bookmark in Neptune
Beach. I hope you'll all come out. If you love dogs, if you love a cute story uplifting in this climate, please come out.
And we need to point out, too, you are currently based in South Florida.
I am, Miami.
But made the run up here to North Florida.
Correct.
Very different politics.
I'm on
up
the book
here.
Tour. Oh, yeah. But not so different because, you know, I'm Cuban and I'm in the Cuban community. And they're kind of outliers of the Latino vote in that they're more conservative.
It's going to be a great book signing and talk with Lou Aguilar. His book, Jake for Mayor, is the perfect read right now. Go meet him tomorrow, 7 p.m., at the Bookmark in Neptune Beach.
And go meet Jake, more important. 7 o'clock. Thank you.
All right. And we'll have Culpepper in just a moment.
Turkey is vitally important to the United States on Syria, Iraq, and terrorism. But after a failed coup attempt in Turkey, these allies are at odds.
It's not going to be an earthquake type of rupture. This crisis will also be weathered.
Our series, A Nation Engaged, looks at how the next president will manage that relationship. Later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Join WJCT and Baptist Health for Girls Day Out, Saturday, September 17th, Hyatt Hotel. The day will include great national and local speakers that will inspire and empower you to live your life to the fullest. Tickets are $40. Do not miss out. Log on to WJCT.org/Girls Day Out.
Hello, this is Todd Smith, your Deputy Director for the City of Jacksonville's Emergency Preparedness Division. Disasters can strike with little to no notice. Create your disaster kit now, including water, non-perishable foods, batteries, flashlight, weather radio, and important documents. Visit jacksready.com for more information and tune to 89.9, the designated emergency broadcaster for Northeast Florida.
This segment is brought to you by Colo CSX Data Center Hosting Solutions.
Welcome back. Well, finally this hour, veteran concert promoter Ray Lewis has been supporting musicians in Jacksonville for decades. But these days, his listening room concept at the Mudville Grill has brought in an incredible array of singer-songwriters who perform in an intimate environment. Lewis joins us now with more about his career, the music, and a special event happening at Mudville tomorrow night. Good to see you.
Good morning, Melissa.
What a career and what stories you've been able to pile up over the years in Jacksonville. It's pretty amazing, I have to say, first off.
Well, yes, it's been wonderful. Met some great people through the music, and that's why I'm here today, because of the music, too.
Now, there's going to be a special event at Mudville, a benefit, tomorrow night. We'll talk about that in a moment. But this is, it's my understanding, a really satisfying concept for you. It's a listening room concept.
Yes, because there's music as background in so many places, and two, people don't think of acoustic music, mainly the guitars, as being an artistic form, and I'm trying my best to preserve that and make the grassroots movement better known to people and give all these artists a place to come and perform.
And I would think not only does the audience love this, this is great for the artist. This is a really kind of a unique venue for the artist.
Yeah, some of them are surprised sometimes when they come and people are actually listening.
Yeah, they're actually really engaged in it, yeah. And it's not that many tables, and it's a separate space from the restaurant. This is the listening room at Mudville, seating capacity of about a little over 100, right?
Yeah, 120 is the legal capacity.
Yeah. Okay. And when you think back on who you've brought in over the last year or two, who's really standing out in your mind?
Well, most recently, Supertramp's guitarist Carl Verheyen was there with his group. And then about 2 years ago, the guitarist for Paul McCartney's band Wings, Lawrence Juber, was there.
Very cool.
And bluegrass, Zydeco, Celtic music.
When you look at the music scene over the decades you've been involved with it here in this part of the world, what do you see as the major trends emerging?
Ooh. it's very difficult. There's many distractions for people, and for them to get out and come to sit and listen to music is very rare because they have so much available to them at home and mm-hmm. even now on their phones. And that's the trend of getting to we don't want to see the live performance go away.
Yeah, there's just nothing like hearing it live.
No.
There's just nothing like that. And you try to do these concerts at Mudville every Thursday and Saturday night.
Well, other nights too. It just yeah. Some of it depends on when some of the touring artists are coming through. But we do a lot of local artists too, mainly the original music for everybody.
Now, let's talk about what's happening tomorrow night at the Mudville Music Room. And by the way, it's the third anniversary. This is an evening to benefit Pet Rescue North, Inc.
Yes, we did a benefit for them last year for the 50th anniversary for the Beatles, and we raised over $1,000 for them. And I went up and met the lady up there, and this, you know, they don't have a fancy facility up there, but they are a no-kill shelter, a rescue shelter. And I met this lady, Peggy Haynes, who dedicates her life to these animals. And so we can do a little bit to help them is great.
How can people buy, this is admission by donation. People can just walk up to the door, donate what they're able to.
Yes, and several local businesses have given us items to raffle off, which every dollar from tomorrow night is going to go to Pet Rescue North, every single dollar.
Very nice. And this is a celebration of your third anniversary of the Mudville Music Room.
Yes.
Which is nice. Did you think it would last this long?
No, it's been difficult because the fact that it is a separate room, it works. People know when they come in the door, it's going to be about the music, and so that makes life easier for the people out there who really want to sit and listen.
Sure. Well, kudos to you, Ray Lewis, bringing so much great music to the area for decades. He's veteran concert promoter Ray Lewis, and tomorrow night, it's the third anniversary of the Mudville Music Room, an evening to benefit Pet Rescue North, Inc. Admission is by donation. Come on out to Mudville at 7 o'clock tomorrow. They are at 3105 Beach Boulevard, right where Beach and Atlantic split.
Yes, in the St. Nicholas neighborhood.
In the St. Nicholas neighborhood. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Melissa.
And finally this hour, the Jags won the preseason, but in some concerns as the regular season approaches.
I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper. Wouldn't you like to be a pepper too?
Jaguars beat the Bengals, but some issues. Cole Pepper's on the line with more. Hey, Cole, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Yeah, you know, it's interesting. In the regular season, there's a phrase that is very popular in the NFL, and it's about winning ugly. An ugly win is better than a pretty loss in the regular season. In the preseason, in some regards, you're actually looking for style points. And the Jaguars, yesterday on national TV, playing the Bengals in the preseason, their first team, when they were against the Bengals' first team, did not have a very good performance. In fact, they were down 14-3 when the Bengals started pulling their starters out of the game. And the third is usually the most important preseason game because the starters play the most extensive minutes in that game. You try to do a little bit of game planning and try to simulate as much as possible what you're going to do in the regular season. The Jaguars' first two preseason games, although they were losses, the first team played very well. So those were, you know, pretty losses, so to speak, which is kind of what you really want to see. You don't care about a loss. You want to see good performances in the preseason. But now, all of a sudden, in the most important preseason game of the year, the Jaguars have their worst performance. So if there are some concerns, offensive line in particular, they made a change on the front of the offensive line. On the left side, Kelvin Beachum, who was brought in the offseason as a free agent for Pittsburgh, was put into the left tackle spot. Luke Jokel, who had played pretty well at left tackle the first two games, was moved inside to guard. It did not go well. So now, suddenly, Gus Bradley and company have a real issue facing themselves. How do they get ready for the regular season with the final preseason game coming up on Thursday in Atlanta? That's a game that usually starters play very little, if at all. But I think now, at least on the offensive line, they're going to have to find a way to do that. The other thing that happened on the defensive side, they got pushed around by Cincinnati. And Cincinnati's a good team, but it looked like a varsity versus junior varsity scrimmage for much of the first half.
All right, let's talk about college football. It's that time of year again.
It is. And the weekend approaches. They actually started the college football season in Sydney, Australia, the other day. It's the first time they played a game in Sydney, yeah, as you might expect. But now it gets underway in earnest this weekend with the first full weekend of activity. Florida plays this weekend. Georgia plays this weekend. Florida will have Luke Del Rio at quarterback, the son of Jack Del Rio, who's bounced around to several schools and won the starting quarterback job for the opening week anyway. Georgia opens up a new era with a new coach. Kirby Smart took over for Mark Richt. And then Florida State plays a week from tonight on Monday night. So this first full weekend certainly is going to start to, I think, clarify some of the storyline in college football. Of course, it also changes the tempo of things, the conversations around town will probably start to feel a little bit different than they have in the last couple of months.
Okay, and of course, you're the voice of the Armada. They were off this week, but 11 matches remaining in the season. What's going on with soccer?
Well, right now you've got the Armada four straight matches without a loss, and they'll go on the road this weekend. Next three Saturdays they have road games before coming back home on September the 24th to play against Rio, Oklahoma City. And this is an important stretch for the Armada from this standpoint. Mark Lowry, the interim head coach, is really going to be judged on what happens here the rest of the season to see if the young Englishman will wind up being the permanent head coach for the team. That's really the big storyline here for the last 11 games of the season. We're officially right now halfway through the fall season for the Armada. So a pretty good test for Mark Lowry to prove himself as the head coach of the team.
And then lastly, just a few home stands left for the Suns later this week, but a loss over the weekend in Pensacola.
You have five games remaining, and it's at home anyway. That starts on Thursday, and then that's it for the season. And so last chance to get out to the baseball park to see the Suns play coming up later this week.
Culpepper, follow him on Twitter at Culpepper for all your sports news and notes, and thanks for being here.
Thanks, Melissa.
That's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Merschart. Michelle Corum is running the board. The show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Shevchik. Never miss a show. Subscribe to our daily podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. And next on Diane Rehm, the new CEO of Donald Trump's campaign, is closely aligned with the so-called alt-right, a nationalist movement that rejects multiculturalism, the rise of the alt-right movement, and its place in this year's presidential campaign. That's next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville, your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.